Northern Kentucky for the feast. All right, you have three choices today. You can either plug your ears today, or you can plug your ears when I speak at the feast, or you can listen twice. But I do have a question for everyone to begin today. When you read the Word of God, do you ever put yourself in the pages of the Bible? Not literally, of course. But as you read, as you study, do you ever read the passages from the first person perspective? And not all passages lend themselves to that kind of perspective. David and Goliath, for example. It is an inspiring story, and there's much that we can learn from it. But without actually coming face to face with a 10-foot giant who is intent on killing you, you can't really get the full impact of that moment if you try to read it in the first person. I am, of course, assuming that you would put yourself in the position of David and not Goliath. Now, that aside, there are passages that easily can and should be read from the first-person perspective. The letters to the seven churches in Revelation, for instance, are, I believe, most useful for you and me today if we read them from the first-person perspective. As I read, as you read, we should hold the descriptions of those churches up to ourselves. Is this me? Do I see the characteristics that Christ is correcting in my own life? The example that stands out the most, at least to me, is Laodicea. The defining characteristic of the Laodiceans is that they see themselves one way, but they have no idea that the truth is actually exactly the opposite. To put it simply, someone in a Laodicean frame of mind would read those verses and say, "That's not talking about me." And that's, of course, just one example. Please turn to Luke chapter 19 and verses 11 through 17. Here in Luke is a passage that we should all read in the first person perspective, especially as we go to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Luke 19 and verse 11. Now, as they heard these things, he spoke another parable, because he was near Jerusalem, and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately. Therefore, he said, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. So he called 10 of his servants, delivered to them 10 minas, and said to them, "Do business till I come." But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, "We will not have this man to reign over us." And this is where I want us to start putting ourselves into the scriptures. Verse 15. And so it was that when he returned, having received the kingdom, he then commanded his servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. Picture this moment in your mind. Jesus Christ has returned. He has destroyed the armies that are gathered against Jerusalem. Satan has been locked away, and Jesus Christ is setting up his kingdom to rule over the entire earth. And he starts calling his servants to report on their work. He calls you. Verse 16. Then came the first, saying, Master, your mina has earned 10 minas. And he said to him, to you, well done, good servant. Because you were faithful in a very little, have authority over 10 cities. The King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, says to you, well done. These are the cities that I want you to rule. Are you ready to rule those cities? Will you be ready to rule your cities? The world to come will be completely different than the one we see today. But does it just happen? Or is there something more to it? Do you play a role in making it different? Today, let's take a deeper look at what will make the world of the millennium different, and the minas that you have been given to grow and use to rule your cities. To begin, please turn to Isaiah 2 and verses 1 through 4. Now, this idea of putting yourself into the pages of the Bible is not new. I didn't come up with it. And it's actually why we go to the Feast of Tabernacles. God says, gather your tithe. Go. Be around God's people in the presence of His Spirit for 8 days and experience a small taste of the world that He is going to create. Picture yourself, he says, in these verses during the Feast of Tabernacles, and hold on to that picture. And God says, Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 1, the word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. A world without wars. A world without the weapons to wage wars. War won't even be taught. There will be no more West Point, no Naval Academy, no military academies of any kind. No one will learn war anymore. It's been said that the history of humanity is the history of war. The most important dates in history are marked by wars, by battles that sent mankind in one direction instead of another. So is this just a fanciful idea, a world without war? Or is it real? Will it be real? How will it become real for everyone who lives? Turn to James chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Now, perhaps, to make it real for us today, we should take a look at where wars come from. You might think that wars come from very complex issues, but James says no. Wars are actually caused by something very simple. James chapter 4 and verse 1. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. James says wars come from desires for pleasure. They come from lust. James says that war comes from coveting. It comes from something as simple as wanting something that belongs to someone else. The Greek words for wars and fights in verse 1 are polemos and makai. Now, those words can be used to refer to fighting between nations, and they can be used to refer to strife between individuals, fighting between neighbors, between husbands and wives, between brothers and sisters. To put it simply, the source is the same regardless of the scale. Fights among family members start from wanting something that doesn't belong to you. And things like World War II start from wanting something that doesn't belong to you. Coveting leads to conflict. Please turn to Philippians chapter 4 and verses 1 through 13. Building a world without war isn't just a magic trick. Poof! No Satan, and suddenly everyone gets along perfectly. A world without war is built under the leadership of rulers who understand the cause of war and who understand what to do about it. A world without war is built under the leadership of those who have grown the minas that are needed to build that world. Philippians 4 and verse 11 says, "Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound." Notice, contentment is not a function of how much you have. You can be poor and covetous. You can be rich and covetous. You can be poor and content. Or you can be rich and content. Paul learned to be content when he had very little. And Paul learned to be content when he had a lot. Everywhere and in all things, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Jesus Christ has given you understanding, the minas that contentment is the key to eliminating strife and wars. And a world without war will be built under the leadership of those who have grown and will teach contentment. Please turn to Amos chapter 9 and verses 11 through 14. And try to get there without singing a song in your head. The book of Amos has a lot to say about God's judgment on Israel for their rebellion against him. It describes the calamity that comes on a people who reject God. But God is gracious and merciful. And at the end of the book, Amos, under the inspiration of God, describes the world that is to come. The world that we are going to picture. In Amos 9 and verse 11, "On that day I will raise up the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down, and repair its damages. I will raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom, and all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord, who does this thing." It was always God's intention to include the Gentiles. "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him who sows seed. The mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. I will bring back the captives of my people Israel. They shall build the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them. They shall also make gardens and eat fruit from them." The earth, under the reign of Jesus Christ, will be more productive than anything we've ever seen. Now, the United States may be on thin ice in a lot of ways, including agriculturally. But if you drive through the Midwest, you'll see cornfields and wheat fields. And you'll see that the land is still very productive. But even at its best, the produce of this current age will pale in comparison to the world to come. The harvest won't even be in, and it's time to start planting again. God will heal the land. No more of those weeds that God cursed the ground with when Adam and Eve disobeyed. Picture it, a world without Brussels sprouts. I know, some people like Brussels sprouts. But everyone who tells me Brussels sprouts are good has some recipe that ensures they don't taste anything like Brussels sprouts. Deep fry them, smother them in cheese and chocolate, wrap them in bacon, turkey bacon, and then they're delicious. Tell me that's not a weed. But seriously, the people in and around your cities will enjoy the fruit of the field, the fruit of the vineyard, and the fruit of the gardens. And there will be no lack. But are there any potential pitfalls? Is the difference just in the land? Now, there's plenty of productive land in this world. And not just in the United States, there's good soil in all kinds of places. Is there something else that will be different? Let's go to Luke chapter 12 and verses 16 through 21. Something else will have to be different. And we actually alluded to it earlier in Paul's letter to the Philippians. Your citizens have to learn how to abound. Managing a world with that kind of abundance will require something from the people that's missing today. Luke 12 and verse 16. Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?' So he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater. And there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided?' So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." "Wow," he says, "I've got way more stuff than I need. I need more space so I can keep all my stuff." Plentiful ground is not a cure for the natural human tendency toward greed. The people of Corinth, it seemed to have plenty of money, and they did share it. But they also had trouble opening their wallets when it came to Paul. And the same is true today. Consider organizations like the Red Cross and Goodwill. Both do a lot of good in this world, but at the same time, they both have CEOs that make over $500,000 a year. And because they are both large organizations, that means there's also a lot of other people who need to be paid as well. They do a lot of good for people, but in this world mixes good and evil. It mixes giving and greed. Please turn to Proverbs 11 and verses 24 through 26. So what are the minas that you've been given to grow in this life to rule your cities in the next life? What are the minas that will be needed by the people in your cities? Proverbs 11 and verse 24. There is one who scatters, yet increases more. And there is one who withholds more than is right, but it leads to poverty. The generous soul will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. The one who does good for others has good come to him. The people will curse him who withholds grain, but blessing will be on the head of him who sells it. Give, and you'll end up with more. Help, and you'll get help. Share what you have, and you will be blessed. We have been given the understanding of the value of generosity. Generosity benefits the recipient and the giver. To grow your minas, to grow our minds, we need to look for ways to be generous. And we need to look for ways where we might be a little greedy, or maybe just not as cheerful a giver. Because generosity is not limited to money. For some people, sharing money is easy. But maybe the struggle is being generous in other ways, like with our time. We can buy gifts for people all day long, but to give up a Sunday to help someone else is very difficult. Maybe you've noticed, as I have, it seems like every year there is at least one feast site that is asking for more volunteers, sometimes even only a week before the feast begins. Now, many of us have been in the church for a long time. So there may be many here who, like my father, spent years helping people find seats as an usher, or helping people park their cars in the sun with the sun beating down on them, or working parking while getting drenched by a hurricane, with kids who wanted to sleep in a little bit more before services, but he came early. With kids who just wanted to go have fun and do fun things and stayed late after services to serve. And in the process, he taught those kids that you don't come to the feast to take. You come to give. Let's go to Matthew chapter 20 and verses 25 through 28 for one last bit of insight on this point. And of course, I should add, my brothers and I always listened when our parents talked. And we always paid attention and followed through on the lessons that they tried to teach us. Or maybe we were like everyone else. We were given minas, and it was our responsibility to grow them, to learn how to use them. Matthew 20 and verse 25. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." As I said, maybe you used to take lots of people to dinner at the feast. But you just don't have as much second tithe as you used to. Maybe you've done those service jobs for years, and now it's someone else's turn to do those things. And now your opportunity to give is in teaching others the value of generosity, not just at the feast, but all year long. I realize that for some, passing on what you've learned about generosity just doesn't feel like giving in the same way that actually doing the stuff does. But that may be exactly what you need to do to grow your minas at this point. Because that may be exactly what Jesus Christ wants you to do for your citizens. Of your cities, for your cities to thrive in a world full of abundance. Please turn to Ezekiel chapter 34 and verses 23 through 28. And it will help if I get out of Jeremiah. Now, like Amos, Ezekiel was in a position to prophesy against his people, Judah in this case, because of their rebellion against God. Ezekiel delivers prophecies against the people and against the leaders who led them astray. And like in Amos, God does not deliver his judgment without a promise of better things to come. Ezekiel 34 and verse 23. I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. He shall feed them and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. David has been raised from the dead, and God has made him king over Israel once again. Verse 25. I will make a covenant of peace with them and cause wild beasts to cease from the land, and they will dwell safely in the wilderness and sleep in the woods. Have you ever slept in the woods and wondered what's out there? I will make them and the places all around my hill a blessing. And I will cause showers to come down in their season. There shall be showers of blessing. Then the trees of the field shall yield their fruit, and the earth shall yield her increase. They shall be safe in their land, and they shall know that I am the Lord. When I have broken the bands of their yoke and delivered them from the hand of those who enslaved them. And they shall no longer be prey to the for the nations, nor shall beasts of the land devour them. But they shall dwell safely, and no one will make them afraid. God will make a covenant. This is a promise from God of peace. Picture it. God changes the nature of wild animals to make them gentle. The rain will always come when it's supposed to, and always in the right amount. No hurricanes or tornadoes flattening homes or washing away entire neighborhoods. And those rains, and with those rains, the fruit will always come. Never again will there be cause for people to go to bed hungry, unless they're fasting. Starvation will be nothing but history. God will put an end to bondage, bondage from other people, and the bondage of Satan over the whole earth. God will take away the things that people are afraid of. But is that all it takes? Please turn to 1 John chapter 4 and verses 17 and 18. The 16th century philosopher Michel de Montaigne is credited as saying, "My life has been full of terrible misfortune, most of which never happened." People can worry about, can be afraid of, things that will never happen. And even when there's nothing to be afraid of, especially at, say, the beginning of the millennium, for the people who survive the Great Tribulation and see the results of God's wrath, I expect those people especially will need some convincing that there is nothing to fear. So what else, what will convince them? 1 John 4 and verse 17. Love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. The people of this world are fearful of many things. All those things that God promises to change and more. They are tormented by their fears. And the leaders of this world throughout history have never removed that torment. And some of them have even been the cause of that torment. What is lacking from the human governments of this world? Love. Building a world where no one is afraid will take God's miraculous intervention to remove the things in this world that are actually scary. And it will also require love from the rulers to calm whatever fears, whatever torment still lives in the minds of the human beings who still walk the earth. So, what can you and I do today to prepare to be those kinds of rulers? Let's go to John 15. In verses 9 through 13. Now, the version of love offered by this world, by Satan's world, can be little more than a feeling. Love can come and love can go. And there's nothing required of you to love another person. These verses are, of course, connected to the Passover, as they are the words of Jesus Christ on the last night before his crucifixion. But in these verses, we'll find two concrete things that we can do to grow the love that will be needed from the rulers of the world to come. And I can guarantee you that at least one of them is not considered necessary for love in this world. But God says we cannot have his love without it. John 15 and verse 9. As the Father loved me, I also have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. If you want to love the people of your cities the way they will need to be loved, if you want the love that casts out fear, the first thing for you and I to do is keep the commandments. Now, I imagine we're all familiar with 1 John 5 and verse 3. You don't have to be in the church for very long before you have this explained to you. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. This world does not associate love with commandment keeping. And in fact, keeping God's commandments is increasingly viewed as hateful in this world. But when Jesus Christ rules over the earth, in that world, out of Zion shall go forth the law. And the rulers of that world will spread the law to the people of their cities, because that law brings peace. Keeping that law isn't just required for love. It is love. Verse 11. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. The second thing you and I can do today to build our love is lay down our lives for others. To sacrifice ourselves for others. You can die for another person. Give up your whole life for another person. And Jesus Christ was about to do that. And that is most definitely an act of love. But you can only make that sacrifice once. And in the millennium, as spirit beings, you won't even be able to do that at all. But that's not the only way to lay down your life. You and I can lay down our lives for others every day. We can give up a piece of our lives for others every day. When you give up something that is important to you for the good of someone else, you are laying down your life for them. When you let a complete stranger go in front of you at the grocery store, you are giving up some of your life. You will stand in that line longer than you would have if you had gone first. And when you do that, you show that person love. And you grow love in yourself. Even if they don't appreciate it, you and I are learning to sacrifice ourselves. And as the ruler of your city, you will give of yourself. You will sacrifice yourself to serve your citizens. And your sacrifice, your love, will cast out fear. Your acts of love will help build a world where no one is afraid. We go to the Feast of Tabernacles for a taste of the world to come. We go and we put ourselves into the pages of the Bible, into those verses that tell us how wonderful the world will be when Jesus Christ is ruling over it with the help of his saints. Can you picture it? Jesus Christ has established his kingdom over all the nations of the earth. He has brought back the captives. He is building a world without war. He's building a world with so much food that people can't even collect it all. He's building a world where no one is afraid. And Jesus Christ calls you. You present him with your minas, grown larger than when he gave them to you. And Jesus Christ says to you, "Well done, good servant. You were faithful with these little things. Now go and use them to rule your cities." I wish you all a wonderful, safe, and inspiring Feast of Tabernacles.